Now, many of us might have strong memories of public school health and sex education. Depending on where you went to school, when you went to school, that might have included taking care of a baby, in quotes. An egg, maybe. A bag of flour or a lifelike doll. Maybe a computerized doll. Recent study in Australia found that women who had participated in programs in school where they had to take care of a fake baby were actually more likely to get pregnant before age 20.
The birth rate in the U.S. has fallen along with increased use of contraception, according to the Guttmacher Institute. How we educate kids about sex has been a hotly debated issue, and it often becomes political. Amid the controversy, it's not always clear how sex education actually affects rates of pregnancy.
Joining us now is Nancy Kendall, an associate professor of educational policy studies and author of the book, The Sex Education Debates. Nancy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
Well, I never had to do any of these in school, I'll say that. And I hadn't heard of these computerized fake babies. Could you talk about this? Is this a commonly used thing in schools now?
Yeah, so they are used in schools across the U.S. We're not actually sure how often they're used because we don't have a lot of good either federal or state level data on sex education practices in most of the U.S. But some of the largest providers, like RealityWorks, which is a provider of the dolls, says that up to 62% of schools are using their babies. I think this is definitely an exaggeration, but there are a lot of kids who come in contact with these infant simulator dolls, or as you said, who come in contact with an egg they're supposed to take care of. In Wisconsin, I've even heard of folks who had to take home chicks, for example, live chicks, to take care of over the weekend.
Well, and so the idea, the thinking, whichever one you're taking home is you realize how much responsibility is, how hard it is to keep track of this fragile thing for so long, and that's going to make you think twice about having a baby yourself. But here's this research in Australia that says maybe the opposite?
Yeah, so there's a study in Australia that basically argues or that shows that in this particular study, the rates of pregnancy for young women under 20 increased following this particular intervention, and the rates of abortion decreased, which, of course, is part of the reason why there were more live births for this group as well. So it looks like the dolls did the opposite of what they were expected to do. The company that provided the dolls has argued that this is because the school system didn't actually use the curriculum that was supposed to go along with the use of the dolls. And that's why it had this outcome. But in the U.S., it's pretty clear from the studies that have been done, pretty consistently, it looks like the infant simulators don't have the effect that they're expected to have. They don't lower teen pregnancy rates. But we also haven't found a negative effect. We haven't seen increases in teen pregnancy rates either in the U.S.
So the idea, the worry, I guess, from this Australian study might be some kids might be scared away from wanting to have a kid, but some said, hey, I got this. I'm handling this just fine. People are paying attention to me, asking me questions about this. I could do this for real.
Absolutely. And actually, we do have some good studies in the U.S. that show that girls who did the infant simulator with curricula that are approved indicated that they were less scared of pregnancy, that they felt they were better prepared to take care of an infant, and that they felt that their future would be better if they had a baby than students who didn't have the infant simulator. So we have reason to believe that this outcome is potentially possible. We can imagine how kids got to feel that having a baby isn't the worst thing in the world.
Well, I want to take a step way back and maybe make this more complicated. You've written in some of your own work that maybe too much of our sex education is focused on a couple of negatives. Don't get pregnant. Don't get a sexually transmitted disease. You think, as I understand it, we should have a wider approach, a deeper approach. What would you like to see a sex education curriculum look like?
You know, I'd really like to see two things. The first one is that the information that is provided in the classrooms, I think, needs to be medically accurate. We have a lot of classrooms and a lot of states in this country where teachers either can or are actually required to give students incorrect information about things like contraceptive failure rates. And I don't think that it's ever a good idea to have schools providing incorrect information to their students, particularly about sex education. But beyond that, beyond this discussion of kind of exactly what facts are given to students, I think we do a pretty bad job in the U.S. of talking honestly with students about how complicated it is to think about sex and sexuality, and the fact that for everyone in their own lives, you know, the decision to have or to not have sex, the decision to respond to sexual assault, something which is often not included in sex education, the ways that we think about sexual identity. These are deeply moral issues for families and for individuals. And we don't let students really talk about that and debate it and have open conversations about it. And what I'd really like to see in our sex education classrooms is a little less fear and a lot more attention to listening to each other and learning from each other and really discussing what values we want to promulgate as a society, instead of either providing false information and not letting students talk about sex and sexuality openly, or only providing, quote-unquote, the facts and not letting students talk about the real struggles they face in their own lives as they think about sex and sexuality.
We'll get more into that as we talk with Nancy Kendall from UW-Madison, author of the book The Sex Education Debates. Talk about sex education and in part about a recent study showing that school programs where students take care of one of these computerized baby simulators were not less likely to get pregnant before age 20.
And we're taking your calls. Do you remember taking care of a robotic baby, a doll, a sack of flour to be a pretend parent? Did your school have comprehensive sex education? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're going to continue this conversation in just a few minutes. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. And we're talking about sex education in schools with Nancy Kendall, Associate Professor of Educational Policy Studies at UW-Madison and author of the book The Sex Education Debates. Our starting point was a recent study showing that taking care of one of those fake babies, a lot of kids are doing this in the schools, didn't really correlate with putting off pregnancy, didn't prevent pregnancy. Nancy, just a few moments ago, you were talking about the kind of sex education you'd like to see in schools. You've written, of course, about debates over sex education. Is it possible, given the range of opinions out there, beliefs about what kids should be taught in schools, whether a sex education should be taught in schools to begin with, is it possible to get a community consensus to have the kind of thing you're looking for?
You know, I think unfortunately for many schools and in many states, it's very difficult for schools to be in the middle of these debates. Schools are rightfully so often quite nervous about legal claims that can be made against them. And they often feel like they're put in a very hard position where anything they say or do is going to set off someone. In my research, and many other people have talked about this as well in their research, many communities are actually relatively on board with what is usually thought of as a comprehensive sex education approach. The vast majority of adults and students and teachers in the U.S. agree that students should receive information, factually correct information about sex and sexuality, including about contraception. But despite the fact that there's actually very high levels of agreement about this across the U.S., it's very hard for schools to implement those kinds of curricula, particularly in more politically and even more than that in some cases, religiously conservative communities and states, because a small but very vocal group of community members are very concerned about allowing that kind of programming to be given. So schools are in a tough position to do this, and teachers in particular are in very tough positions when it comes to standing in front of a classroom and providing a good comprehensive sex education. That doesn't mean that schools shouldn't try. They definitely should. But it does mean that we could do a lot more to support them in trying to get really good sex education programming in schools. One other thing I wanted to add really quickly, if I could, is that sex education, even the best sex education programs, have a significant impact, but it's a limited impact in changing sexual activity for young people. And there's quite a bit of evidence in the U.S. and around the world that if you really want to decrease young women's pregnancy rates and therefore also abortion rates, the most effective way to do this appears to be to radically expand contraceptive access. Many teen pregnancies are unintended pregnancies, and so if young men and women have access to contraception, many of them will choose to use it, and we see pregnancy rates decline significantly. That's exactly what happened in Colorado recently, in fact.
Well, I was going to ask you about that Colorado program. They made contraception available, I think, for free. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but up at a certain age, and unplanned pregnancies for teenagers plummeted, right?
It did indeed. It did indeed. And we've seen that in other places, both in this country and around the world, too. So it seems to be a very effective way to decrease unintended pregnancy rates. Now, that doesn't help us with intended teen pregnancy.
But again, there's a lot of people for religious, moral reasons who are worried that providing contraception sends an implicit message. Thumbs up, kids, it's okay to have sex, which a lot of people don't feel comfortable with.
Absolutely. And the fact of the matter is that's an issue that we actually have a lot of data about, both in the U.S. and around the world. And it's very clear from diverse studies, again, both in the U.S. and around the world, that providing students with accurate information about contraception does not increase the rate at which they have sex or the age at which they have sex. It also doesn't decrease it.
So right now in this country, do we just have a hodgepodge of approaches from state to state, maybe community to community when it comes to sex education?
We sure do. And in fact, we actually have differences from classroom to classroom in a lot of schools. The extent to which different states provide guidance for their schools, their districts and their schools, and the extent to which they provide resources for sex education differs hugely. And so in Wisconsin, for example, since 2012, there has been a framework for sex education. Sex education is not required. HIV/AIDS education is required, but exactly what that means differs significantly around the state. And abstinence, there must be an abstinence focus in that programming in Wisconsin. But that's about the extent of the guidance that's given by the state. And there are very few resources available for schools to teach sex education. And de facto, what that means is that from classroom to classroom, teachers are often creating their own curricula, finding their own materials, and teaching sex education in the way that they think is most appropriate. Or they're asking outside groups to come into their classroom and present a curriculum that an outside group has created.
As we wrap up, it seems like there was an arc more and more toward abstinence-based, abstinence-only education in the United States. Is that still going on, or is that trend reversed at all?
The trend is messy. So Wisconsin, for example, has moved towards support for an abstinence-only approach, again, since 2012. But some states have moved away from it. The real, I think, most interesting turnarounds in this are occurring at the federal level, where there was an effort. The federal government has provided over $2 billion to support abstinence-only sex education approaches, although there's extremely limited data to indicate that these are successful at achieving either their own goals or the public health goals that we usually have as a country for sex education. Despite that, the federal money available to fund those programs has actually increased in the last couple of years again, after decreasing for about 5 years there. So we're seeing real ups and downs in the kinds of programming that we provide resources for and the kinds of programming that we provide political support for.
We'll leave it there. Nancy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Nancy Kendall, Associate Professor of Educational Policy Studies at UW-Madison and author of the book, The Sex Education Debates. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're taking a look now at middle school, those awkward years of 6th through 8th grade when you're not quite a full-on teenager, but you're not a little kid either. The transition from elementary school to middle school can be challenging for kids, and fitting in can be confusing. Here's a clip from the movie Diary of a Wimpy Kid, where the main character, Greg, gets advice from his older brother about how to survive the 6th grade.
So look, Mom asked me to give you some advice about middle school. It's real simple. Don't talk to anyone. Don't look at anyone. Don't go anywhere. Don't sit down. Don't raise your hand. Don't go to the bathroom. Don't get noticed. Don't choose the wrong locker.
It's just that simple. Well, a new study says the stress of going to a new middle school could be taking a toll on kids' academic performance and sense of belonging.
Joining us now is Amy Ellen Schwartz, one of the authors of the study. She is the Daniel Patrick Moynihan Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at Syracuse University's Maxwell School. Amy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start at the beginning. How did you begin to figure out what might be the most beneficial for kids to be in this K through 8 setting longer or to make the jump to middle school?
Well, really came from trying to look for a policy change that you could make that would be affordable and would make things better for kids. And there kept being tantalizing hints here and there that grade span mattered. And we got interested in doing some work to try to track that down. We've got new data, new methods, and, you know, really we were enticed by the idea that we'd be able to try to figure out what matters and why. And so our first bunch of work looked at trying to make sure that it really was differences in grade span and not other things that might be going on, and kind of convinced ourselves that indeed it is grade span that matters, and then to try to track down the mobility explanation. And so we think some of it is mobility. In the most recent work, we tried to understand how it is that the social context differs for kids in middle school and elementary school, and to pursue the top dog, bottom dog hypothesis. And that's really, I think, what's exciting, is that we start to understand that it is in the nature of these grade spans, not in kind of ancillary things about them.
And tell us about what things you looked at, because it's not just all about academic performance, although, of course, parents and kids care a lot about that. I mean, there's all these other factors that go into a successful, healthy kid.
Absolutely. And so I think that that's what we really pursued in this last paper, was trying to understand what's the difference in students' experience of school. You know, when you send your kid to school, what do you want? You want them to be happy. You want them to feel like they belong, like they have friends, like it's a safe place. And we were able to look at those things and to ask, is there a difference in how kids report feeling at school when they're sixth graders in K-6s versus sixth graders in 6-8s? And we found significant differences between those. And so I think that's what's the important thing here, is that we understand, you know, these kids' experiences of school vary, and they vary with the grade span of the school they're in. I mean, sixth grade is hard. It's hard to be 10, 11, 12, 13. Those are hard years. I think we may be making them harder than they have to be.
Well, tell us why. What did you find out about the differences in experience?
Well, kids who are bottom dogs, that is, these kids who are at the bottom of the grade distribution in school, are more likely to report seeing bullying around them. They're less likely to report feeling welcome at school, less likely to report that teachers and people know their names. And the top dogs are the opposite. The kids who are at the top of the grade span distribution are less likely to report seeing bullying, more likely to report feeling welcome, more likely to report teachers know their name, and so on. Put simply, the kids at the top of the distribution, the top dogs, experience a better school environment than the bottom dogs do.
So put another way, you know, if a kid gets to stay in the same K-8 school, the same school, by the time they get to eighth grade, they are at the top of the heap, and they may be at the same school with kindergartners, but they probably, you know, feel like they belong. The teachers know their name. But if they're making the jump to middle school, they're sort of wiping the slate clean, starting new at the bottom of the heap, and then it sounds like there might be some setbacks associated there.
Well, I think there's two things that are going on. The first is that we found that the size of the heap matters. You know, so that being at the top of the K-8 is a good thing. You know, those kids are happy. I mean, those kids have a pretty nice environment. The kids in K-6s, you know, the sixth graders are better off than the sixth graders in middle schools. And so, you know, it could be that by switching to K-8s, we're just going to avoid making those middle school years worse. You know, everybody's going to get out of eighth grade eventually, and most kids are going to be top dogs in eighth grade. But some will have come through kind of a tough period. And we find that kids in K-8s, on average, do better in eighth grade than kids who go to a K-5, say, and then a 6-8. So, you know, everything kind of points to saying these longer grade spans, the K-8s, deliver a better learning environment for the kids, and the kids do better.
And what happens with the academics? I mean, we all want happy kids and kids who feel they belong, but is there a reflection in those same things with grades?
Absolutely. Kids do better. So, again, I'm not looking at grades. We look at test performance and test scores. Looks like these kids are doing better, and some work from other folks have shown the same thing. I mean, you do see sort of consistent evidence from my work and from work by other people that the test scores dip when you switch schools from, you know, the K-5 to the 6-8, but you just don't fully catch up ever. So the kids in K-8s are doing better. Now, what's interesting, we didn't study, but would be worth considering as well, maybe the better thing to do is not K-8 and then 9-12. Maybe we should just do K-12.
That's interesting.
Or maybe we should do K-5 and then 6-12. All really good possibilities. And I think we should, I have some thoughts on how you should think about those and what might be their advantages and disadvantages. But it seems to me that the evidence is really piling up that we've got to give this another thought. This is not expensive. I mean, this is not pie in the sky. If only we had, billions of dollars more for education reform. This isn't that expensive. It's not free, but it's not that expensive. We can change these things.
Well, I think a lot of us remember, including me, that middle school was kind of miserable. I think about my education, you know, through high school, and that was sort of the low point. And I think that's true for a lot of people. You're really in flux at that time. So it makes me wonder, based on what you found, whatever happened to make us decide to do it the way we do it right now and have a separate middle school?
Well, you know, it's interesting. This notion of middle school being miserable is, an American notion. Right? We all have horrible stories about middle school as being the worst time. And so you might think, well, why would anybody ever do that? Well, you know, part of what happens is people see that kids in K-5 have different educational needs. By the time you're in grades 6, 7, and 8, it's not uncommon. In fact, I think it's usual that by that time you're switching classes, and so you go to a separate chemistry lab to study chemistry, and you go to a different room to do biology. And because of that need to move around and be in different classrooms, that sort of has a different structure, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's to facilitate that kind of thing. You don't have kindergartners moving around like that. Now, you know, I don't want to exaggerate. Not that they never move. But most kindergarten classrooms are, they're sort of self-contained. The same group of kids moves from one to another. And then the idea is as they get older at some point, they have differentiated instruction and they have different teachers and different classrooms. So not every room has a chemistry lab in it. There's a chemistry lab and kids move. And so, you know, I think there's a logistical infrastructure kind of reason that you might be tempted to break them up.
Well, you said you had some thoughts about the way we could start thinking about it, and you want us to start thinking about it. You say it's not going to be that expensive a fix. Sounds like there could be some pretty interesting outcomes that would be positive for students. So how do we start thinking about changing it?
Well, one thing to do is really, I think, to start look at where we already do this. If you look in the private school sector, in the independent sector, what's pretty common is that they have K-8s, but they're sort of a lower school and an upper school. And so you kind of keep the social groups together. So you have the same kids go to school, kindergarten, fifth grade. And at the end of fifth grade, this group of students kind of all go together, you know, the upper school. So they have the different classroom structure and they move around and they do those things. But you're not completely disrupting the whole social structure, right? I think we might try some of those things. Have more of these things where you have kind of more tightly articulated schools. So what's pretty common in the U.S. now is you'll have a handful of elementary schools that are relatively small, and they all feed into the one middle school. I think the notion we should be thinking about is, you know, what if we find ways to keep those social groups together. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. I just want to ask you one question that it might come up as you're talking about this, and just very briefly, we're short on time, but what would you say to someone who said, well, everybody has to be at the bottom of the heap sometime. Everybody has to be, you know, the dog who's at the bottom of the heap, and maybe there's change in learning how to be resilient.
Absolutely. The question is, when is a good time for that? You know, not every moment is the moment to have, you know, any lesson. I don't think there's any question that about needing to get kids to be able to adjust and make new friends and change structures. Question is when.
So picking your time matters.
Absolutely. Maybe the best time to do that is in ninth grade. Maybe we need to, I know some places they have these lower schools that are really early grades. You know, it's K-1-2. And then they do 3-8 or something. Maybe the way, as I said, is to do K-5 and 6-12. I'm not sure.
To be continued.
I'm not sure what the right answer is. But I think it's time for us to start thinking a little bit out of the box.
Amy, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Amy Ellen Schwartz. She is a professor of economics and public administration at Syracuse University's Maxwell School. And she joined us to talk about a study she did that found that students in K-8 schools have better outcomes than students who transition from elementary to separate middle schools.